Understand? Got normal supplies for you, sent an IHC dev signal. It is using a mode of one-side directed in given direction or given part of the population that we're seeing.
Okay, I'm not quite sure again since you're breaking in and out. You might be discussing beamforming, which is an interesting technique that you use on people's Wi-Fi access points. Sometimes it's visible on the outside, but sometimes they hide it inside. They have multiple beamforming systems that multiple arrays that can adjust phase orientations and kind of focus their activity to different places electronically.
It is close to what I'm talking about. You feel good now, right?
Well, the last 2 seconds, good. The previous to the last 2 seconds, not so good.
Hold on, let me check it out. Come.
WS1.
Yes, Paul.
I wonder if Wes has tried a different microphone. What is a different microphone? Or for that matter, what is a different radio? He's got one. I'd be curious to see if there's a difference. But maybe not. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I remember the bad old days when for some odd reason the repeater was dropping my audio, and I had to demonstrate that it wasn't my fault by trying two different radios with two different microphones and two different power supplies and two different antennas. I'm not quite sure. I mean, Wesley, do you have any other VHF or radio capable of operating, or is it just the TS-2000?
One is the model version, one is the black version of it.
Now you're dropping out about 80% of the time. You know, I mean, if it's possible, one of these days, try the other TS-2000. I still kind of think it's the connector. So, you know, I wish you had another microphone with another connector. I think that would solve a lot of problems, personally.
I wanted to take the subject, but it's not allowing me to do that, so let's finish up and go to the space report.
Okay, very good, Wesley. I appreciate your participation always, so be well. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Limemark Technical Met. We still have a few more minutes if anyone has any particular question or comment to be made. Hit that push the talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. I have a battery story. WS2S. Call for.
Years ago, when they had the NICAD battery, I think you remember the story, they would be in orbit, close to some up to the satellite, and they'd be charged from the solar panel. But because they go around the Earth every 90 minutes, you know, roughly every 45 minutes, it's daylight, and then 45 minutes at nighttime, so they would be charging and discharging on a regular basis, and they really wind up with a memory problem in their battery. And of course, they couldn't do anything about it, you know, in orbit. So, I guess they were happy when they advancement of battery came around. And they all use lithium ion now. But they used nickel metal hydride for a while. But the night guys were working. Back to work.
Yeah, there are so many poor people traumatized by nickel-cadmium rechargeable batteries and the very problematic problems that they presented where, you know, you'll hear Craig, who probably never saw a nickel-cadmium battery in his life, remind us of people's concerns over a memory effect that no longer exists. It's not by accident that it's practically impossible to find a nickel-cadmium battery anyplace. As soon as metal hydride became practical, and especially when lithium-ion became practical and affordable, nickel-cadmium were thrown away. I don't even know if you can find any out there. They still sell a lot of metal hydride. Nickel metal hydrides are still kind of the favorite rechargeable AA's, BBs, and such. I see them all over the place. There's a whole bunch of different companies that make nickel metal hydride, but no one makes ICANN anymore. So, yeah, may they rest in peace. They were not too great. I mean, unfortunately, we've talked to in the past about how battery design has not kept the pace with electronics in general, and what a wonderful world it would be if they had. And graphene always is the promised material, primarily designed for things that, rather than these chemical batteries that we're used to, are more supercapacitors. They simply have a massive surface area and are able to keep a massive charge. But sometimes that suffices. It's quick charging capacitor, and if it's a low power output, you could use them for all kinds of electronic circuits that require low power output. So, still working on batteries, but nickel cadmium, you're not going to see those anymore, thankfully.
I agree. And now a lot of the cool, like I have a leaf blower now by Greenworks. It's a battery, you know, lithium ion, pork spray. I don't know how many times I've charged the thing. It keeps on going. The one thing they do have with it is apparently they check the temperature. The far charger, you plug it in. Now it doesn't look at the voltage, it looks at the temperature. So let's say you're using that leaf blower, and you unplug it for the first like 5 or 10 minutes, and that's the battery's on them. It's still on the warm side when it's dying. Plug that into a charger, and depending on charge, it senses the heat. Thinks that it's already being charged, and it gets up to a certain temperature, detects any kind of heat, it shuts it down. That's an interesting. I don't know if they have that with all the radios. I think that we buy. I don't know if there's a transistor or anything in those things, but I think that would be a good idea if they do. You know if they have that one?
Yeah, they're designed in some, but not all, usually very smart or fast-charging devices have thermistor controls. I don't know if it was used before it was already charging. I think it's more of a safety feature that if you charge it, it's going to get hotter. And there's a certain temperature it wants to keep below to not create the battery too much. So there's a thermistor that limits the current so that if your battery is sensing that it's overheating on the fast charge, it'll slow it down and support taking longer to charge and saving the life of the battery. So I'm aware of that. They even use that with some nickel metal hydride. new. There have been companies that made that, you know, rapid charging version that have thermistors in them and were able to be thermally controlled. So there's a lot of that going on. You know, the major technology is some aspect of lithium, lithium ion, lithium polymer, and in some instances I have a lithium iron phosphate, which is a very nice battery. It has a lot of recycles in it, and it has a nice discharge curve. Things like lead acid has a rather abrupt, the voltage just kind of dims down to way too low for most of our electronic equipment. But the lithium iron phosphate doesn't really have that steep of a curve, so it's a much lower drop. So they're a nice design. Lithium has a lot of problems. It requires cobalt. Cobalt is a relatively rare metal that's mostly found in Africa. It's mostly mined by children, people who have terrible work conditions. Everyone's trying to limit the amount of cobalt. Different designs are using less cobalt, but all of them require some degree of cobalt. Everyone is really working real hard for new battery technology. I really hope one of these days they come up with something.
Yeah, I agree. I just saw a documentary about electric planes, how far they've come with those. But still not far enough, you know. You're not going to put 100 people in an electric plane and fly them across the country yet. So they got a long way to go. I mean, they work. You know, flight time in the air is relatively short. Same thing with cars. By the way, I don't think there's a day I go out nowadays. I'm in Rockaquan. I don't see a Tesla drive by, you know, and then they have charging stations now. And I believe they all run on lithium ion. And this technology would be, you know, if it was out there, Tesla would have it, that's for sure. They're becoming a lot more popular. I'm telling you, every day, if I go out just shopping, I guarantee I'll see at least one Tesla. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, well, I read an article in the Times a couple of days ago that apparently their sales peaked in the last quarter. It's gone down this particular quarter, apparently. Yeah, they use a lot of lithium ion, and that's kind of a problem. There's only so much lithium, there's only so much cobalt, it's a mess to recycle. It would be great if someone figured out some kind of cheaper solution. You know, we've had chats about hydrogen being used as a fuel source. You know, everyone's sort of looking for something that's very high density but safe. The trouble is they kind of, they're opposite. If it's high energy density, that means it's usually less safe. So it's a big problem that has yet to be fully addressed. You know, I don't quite know how they're planning to do the truck. Tesla showed a truck. Trucks have to carry a lot of things, and the batteries, the power of the trucks probably take up a lot of volume. So I don't know if it's cost effective to have a truck that most of its weight is taken up in the battery mass. But we'll see what happens. He promised that a few years ago. Maybe in 10 or 20 years, they'll actually be selling the trucks. We'll see.
Yeah, he's going to have competition with Ford. They got the 150 that now you could buy, you know, all electric. But the prices are through the roof. But, they are starting to sell them, I think, this year. But, you know, you get very good range on them. They're more powerful than the internal combustion engine that the 150s normally run on. So
In fact, that was the one they showed a year or so ago. Joe Biden got into the thing and took off like 80 miles an hour down a stretch track. That was a Ford 150. But, okay, very good, Brian. Back to you.
AC2GF. Yeah, Rachel Maddow was showing it off last year. All the major automotive companies are going to produce their own electronic vehicles for themselves. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Musk when Tesla has a lot of competition for the EV. Yeah, we'll see. You know, that's what business is. It's, you know, you never just win and sit there and count your laurels. You have to prove yourself every time. So we hope that the future developments in battery technology comes true, and we have rapidly charging, high capacity, inexpensive, easily recycled batteries. That would be fun. Anyway, it's been fun doing my little bit here on the TechNet. I thank everyone who participated tonight, and I hope that you'll come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when I come back and do it all over again. Again, before I leave, just want to remind you that if you want to reach me by email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to call, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. My link page is available. Just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And the audio stream is technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, keep in mind my KC2NJI's great archive site, amateurradio.tv, has more than a million visitors. It has archives of our Limar technical net going as far back as December of 2006. So keep that in mind. And now, full of S2S with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, this is WS1. I was just looking at the number for the TechNet. It started so many years ago. There were a rough number of 1,903 TechNets. You know, I've been accurately counting them for a little over 500 of them. So we're in and around that number, which is a lot. I'm sure Dick would be very happy that the net keeps going and going, and you're doing a great job every week for it. Let me see. Let me go to the first topic here. We have a few things. I don't know if I'm going to make it to 11 o'clock. Let me drop it. Okay. James Webb Space Telescope. JWST, they call it, will soon have pictures. This thing has been being built for over 20 years. They've poured over $10 billion into this project. It was finally launched on an Ariane 5 rocket last Christmas morning. It took over a month to get out to its location, four times the distance of the moon. From Earth, so it travels around the sun just like we do, and you know they've been calibrating it for months, actually for 5 months, realigning all the mirrors. There's 18 different mirrors on 21, a little over 21 foot diameter mirror, and they've been recalibrating it. Then they had to, which took a long time. But then they eventually started work on the four instruments that will do all the picture taking and the seismometers. They have seismographs. You know, they're going to be able to tell what's on different planets, whether it has methane or oxygen. Spectrograph. And you know they have one gadget that actually has a refrigeration system on it. They have a 50 foot shade shading the whole telescope front to keep it cold. Unlike the Hubble, you know, they take pictures, you know, our visible light and slightly infrared. This thing is, they have a far near infrared pictures that are coming back to get those temperatures. You know, infrared is basically heat. They have to keep the telescope or the mirror as cold as possible. They have this 50-foot tennis court size sunshade to do that. It's still not cold enough. You know, they get down to the Kelvin range. It's like 38 degrees Kelvin. That's good for three of the instruments. One of the instruments has to get down to 7 degrees Kelvin. So they actually have a refrigeration or a cascade refrigeration system on board. And it's kind of large. It's probably about, I don't know, 5 feet long by 3 feet wide. And these pistons that go back and forth, and they oppose one another. One goes one direction, the other one goes the other direction. And they do that to eliminate vibration. It's the last thing you want on a telescope, vibration. But anyway, on the 12th of this month, on a Tuesday, two Tuesdays from now, 10:30 in the morning, at the JPL, they're going to release pictures, the first pictures from what they've downloaded from the James Webb Space Telescope, and it should be pretty good. They're claiming it. They've already looked at the rough pictures that have come back, and they said it's going to be dramatic. It's going to change the way we think of everything. The Hubble took the deep field picture, and that went, you know, the universe is, 13.8 billion years old. It went beyond that 1 billion, first 1 billion years, went down to like 800 million years. And James Webb is supposed to go beyond that. But it's got to do other things, too. It's got coronagraphs in front of the camera, which will block certain stars' light, and they'll be able to pick up maybe a photograph or maybe a planet going around those stars, who knows. Certainly they expect to get spectra from that, from those planets, to be able to see if there's oxygen or methane, which would be an indication of possible life, if there's methane. That's an indication of a possibility. But just the idea that they'll be able to pick up signatures of the atmosphere, from light years away, is going to be pretty impressive. So looking forward to that. They said around 10 pictures should be coming out. And at some point, they want to point it at maybe a planet within the solar system, and we have close-ups of a lot of things in our solar system. I guess it's going to be good to, to get an A-B type of picture, compare Hubble with James Webb, or compare pictures that were taken with New Horizon as they went out to as a photograph of Pluto. I'm sure we're not going to beat that. That thing came within, less than 1,000 miles of Pluto. So it should be interesting. $10 million, over 20-year-old project is about to pay off. They think that the quality is going to be much better than was predicted. And also the lifespan. They were hoping to get 5 years out of it. Now, 6 months ago, I heard possible 10 years. I just read now the other day, they're thinking they can get 20 years out of James Webb. And why is that? Because the accuracy of the launch launched from Kourou, French Guiana, South America. On the European Space Agency heavy lift rocket, the Ariane 5, the accuracy of that rocket made it where they didn't really need to use much fuel on the way out to the L2 point, where they're located now, fourth planet to this point, from the moon, from Earth. So they saved a lot of fuel, and they're going to be able to use that. They're in a, they call it a halo orbit. So every now and then, you know, they're going to start to drift out of that halo orbit. You know, there's gravitational pulls that affect things. But, you know, for the most part, it's just going to stay in one location. But as it drifts off and goes one way or the other, you know, they'll fire thrust to one way or another. They think they now have enough fuel to stay out there for, you know, and operate for 20 years. Fascinating. Any questions or comments? WS. Nothing hard. I've been coming through, haven't I, Roy?
Yes, you've been coming through good.
Okay. I always have more power. So, very good. NASA just recently sent up a new type of instrument, new satellite. Satellite is maybe about, I don't know, 50 pounds or so, but it's a bunch of CubeSats put together. CubeSat is roughly 10 centimeters square, you know, a cube, or four inches cubed, and they put, I think this one's got like half a dozen CubeSats put together, and it's got panels that open up to supply power. Now this one is called the Compact Total Radiance Monitor Satellite. Now, it was launched by Virgin Orbital. And it's a new type of satellite where, detector anyway, where they use these nanotubes which create the darkest surface possibly that you can make on the surface. Now, the idea of this satellite is to check out how much light or how much heat from the sun is not only coming into the Earth's atmosphere, but how much is leaving. And they want to know basically the budget of the amount of heat that stays in the Earth's atmosphere. With this information, it helps determine global warming. It becomes part of the data. So you have a history of this. You have a history dating back, they said, 40 years now. And that was this satellite. It was other ones that did the same thing. They detected the amount of heat. Much larger satellites, very big, thousands of pounds. This thing is only a couple of CubeSats, maybe 50 pounds. And the idea is, you know, can they make these satellites smaller and less expensive to operate? You know, can you put one up and if one fails, have another one go up, you know, overnight? And apparently, you can. This was launched by Virgin Orbital. What, around 2 days ago. Virgin Orbital is owned by Richard Branson. He's the same guy that owns Virgin Galactic, but he's got another company, Virgin Orbital, which now launches satellites in space. The way he does it, has a big 747 airplane. And on the left wing, he attaches a rocket. Well, he calls it Launcher. No, Launcher. That's the name he gave. He gave it. Nothing fancy. But he dropped it from the wing at 45,000 feet. Got these
Newton engine.
It's a three-stage setup. And it's enough power to push small satellites into space. And with this last launch a couple days ago from Mojave Desert, I believe they did it at night, first night launch for Virgin Orbital. And they successfully put these satellites into orbit. Now, one of them is this, I think it's a half a dozen different satellites, but one of them is this one that the contact total here that monitor satellite now. You know, the accuracy, I think it's only, the detector is only maybe a couple of square inches, if that. But by making them that small and that inexpensive, they won't have to worry about continuing that 40-year record of the budget of the amount of heat that stays within inside the atmosphere. So it's an advancement for them. But I remember talking about this stuff, the nanotubes on this net, and I think Roy brought it up where it became, you know, the blacker substance going, so the blacker something is, the more heat it's going to absorb. They attached this to a substrate. Almost like a solar panel. And that substrate has electricity going through it. And what it does is it measures the onboard electricity from the satellite. And it could detect any change. So if there's a slight increase of heat, it will change the current flow inside of the system. And then through that, they're able to determine, you know, voltage and the amperage, and they send that information back on a data stream, and they're able to pick it up, and they can actually tell them exactly how much, I don't know how many decimal points, but they can tell them exactly how much heat is there. But they know on the dark side, you know, when it's in light or when it's dark, they know how much heat is going one way or the other. I don't know, it's pretty good advancement. The first practical purpose I remember hearing of this nanotubes that are very hard to make, but you don't need many of them for this purpose, but they're actually using this for scientific investigation. Something that we talked about on the net, I don't know how many years ago it was, and before I remembered, but I specifically remember it was so black that almost people wanted to use it as an art form. Any comments or questions? WS.
Yeah, Paul.
Yes, Roy, do you remember this stuff?
Yeah, I did a story about 3 years ago. This company uses nanotechnology. They create these nanotubes in order to produce something that barely reflects any light. So it's 99.99% black or something. When you paint it on something, you can't tell what its shape is. It just looks like an outline. So they gave one artist the right to use it for his art, and he drew a circle in a museum. But it wasn't a museum it wasn't a circle on the hole. They dug a hole and then they covered the hole with the black paint. But you couldn't tell whether there was a hole or what the hell was going on. It could have just been a flat black paint on a smooth surface. And they cordoned it off, and wouldn't you know it, some guy visiting from Spain, I think it was a museum in Italy, decided to check out the hole and fell into it.
I remember that. That's it, yeah. Okay, those two stories were the same. So that was nanotubes. That, okay, that was some other kind of paint.
No, this particular paint is the blackest black available. There is an artist out there who plays around with other materials who has a slightly less black black, but it's a lot cheaper, and you could actually order it and get a tube and play with it. YouTube is full of guys who have painted the room that color black, and it does tricks to your mind. But the actual nanotube technology, only this one artist gets to play with it, apparently. Otherwise, it's for industrial purposes.
Well, I'm glad this technology is going to practical science, scientific value. Yeah, and I read that before you said with this stuff, 99.999% of the heat is light is well, light is basically the same thing. 100% like it's probably 100% of it is going into the substrate and eventually transmitted back to Earth. Very good. Okay, thanks for that, Roy. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Nothing heard. Anyway, there's another interesting launch that occurred again this week. Again, a couple of days ago, the Capstone launch. They've been looking to get this thing off the ground for quite a while. It's a NASA project. And the Capstone stands for, I have it here, Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. Essentially, it's a small satellite, spacecraft. Again, I think this is a 12 CubeSats bolted together, again with solar panels and everything. And they made Rocket Lab is owned by Peter Beck. He launches the Electron rocket out of New Zealand. And, so this is a big deal for that company. It's a lunar launch, they see. That Capstone is to the moon. And it's a successful launch, nighttime launch. And it's right now in orbit around the Earth. And it's going to make a half a dozen orbits around the Earth each one. He's going to be firing a third stage or a kick stage at just the right time. Each time it gets further and further, more elliptical, closer to the moon, until eventually it breaks the orbit of the Earth and then eventually starts heading out toward the moon. And the goal is to actually get it into a halo orbit around the moon. And looking at the moon, it would be, not in the ecliptic with us, but, 90 degrees opposing that. In other words, going over the north pole of the moon and the south pole of the moon. Primarily an elliptical orbit where it would be like 6 to 7 days just to make one orbit. So we spent a lot of time on the south pole, and then relatively short time on the north pole. And why do they want to do that? Why does NASA want to do that? It's a rectilinear halo orbit, they call it. So this thing, it really doesn't get affected by the gravitation of the mass concentration. It has mass concentration. The density inside the moon, which tends to foul up orbits if you're flying close, like 100 miles above the surface. So, you would need a lot of fuel to keep it in that orbit, over the years. but in this rectilinear orbit, this thing going in, which will be, I mean, roughly, like on the north pole, probably 1,000 miles above it, but on the south, southern side, it'll be going like 43,000 miles away. Now, the idea of this is they want to check this orbit out, the stability of it, and that's why it's a small spacecraft. And if it works out good enough, this is where they plan on putting our next space station, NASA's next space station, not around Earth, but around the moon called Gateway. And eventually you'll have a permanent or semi-permanent occupation of three or four occupants in lunar orbit on this rectilinear halo orbit, for all those plans. So this is actually the start of putting a new space station in space, which of course someday we'll have, let's say, four astronauts, maybe in the early days staying at, say, 40 days at a time, extending that longer and longer, and then, you know, they'll bring different crews there. But, you know, as well as I do, half the astronauts, if not more nowadays, have their hand lights. So instead of having, you know, CQ, CQ, ISS, we'll have CQ, CQ, Gateway. We'll be looking for a Gateway contact, which will be really cool. So in a sense, this is the beginning of putting a special event station around the moon. Now, got Peter Beck launched this thing from New Zealand. Like I said, he's got now two launch pads in New Zealand he can launch from. Capstone, a couple of years ago when this was all being planned, more than a couple of years ago now, it was originally supposed to be launched from the United States, from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. Rocket Lab has built a complete complex in Virginia, like ready to go, but he's still waiting for approval for the terminal flight system that they have on board rocket in the United States. TFS, the terminal flight systems, are explosives that they put inside the rocket, so in case they launch from Virginia and things start to go haywire and start to, you know, it's like it's going to head back to land or something, things could not only be terminated by ground, but goes way off course, the computers on board the spacecraft or the rocket itself will ignite everything. Sure thing. So they're waiting for that approval, and they've been waiting for a year now. So Capstone should have been launched from there, but due to the delays of the TFS, the terminal flight system, the launch that it took off from New Zealand successfully, he launched from the North Island, if you look at the map. And that's where his launch pads are. So I thought it was pretty interesting. We'll know by, I think, November. I think as long as November to get into that proper orbit. What happens is Capstone, you know, is going, you know, after it goes through half a dozen loops around the Earth and start heading to the moon, it's actually going to pass the moon. It's going to go really far past the moon. Like, I've read, you know, like 500,000 miles past the moon. And then eventually it'll like come to a stop, and then due to the sun's gravitational pull and actually the moon, it will actually start pulling itself back and eventually fall into this unusual orbit. Yeah, so it should actually take up until November. Now, when we launch crew to the moon, of course, that's not going to happen. You know, we have to get there quick. So it'll be like power, you know. It was 3.5-4 days and these guys were in orbit around the moon. The same thing's going to happen on the launch, the space launch system. You're going to launch there and then you'll be able to fire there the upstage rocket, which will, at that point, will be liquid helium, liquid oxygen. The rocket will be able to reignite that to get it to go up around the moon, or even the service module itself will have engines on that to be able to do the same thing. Any questions or comments? WS. Okay, nothing hard. One other topic that was pretty interesting. NASA launched they call it a brand rocket. Brand rocket is a suborbital flight. A suborbital rocket. Usually they launch them from Wallops Island, or they actually launch them from Florida. They're called sounding rockets. You know, you'll have colleges or different universities building spacecraft or detectors that they go into suborbital flight. Sometimes they go up hundreds of miles. And they just come back down with a parachute and recover them. But now this is the first time NASA has done it from Australia. You know, they went down there and they have these small telescopes that they put on board this thing that they want to take pictures of, in this case, Alpha Centauri and the other couple of planets that are going around that star. And if you look at the declination and everything about the story, you really have to be south of the equator. So they launched from the northern part of Australia, again, last week. Apparently it went well. It was the first launch from Australia of any kind in over 20 years, 25 years, I think. And even then, that was no big deal that they had whatever they launched. Australia is trying to get back into the swing of things. They built their launch pad there in that part of Australia, north central of Australia. But NASA was pretty happy about this. They sent around 70 people down there to do this for NASA. And apparently it went well. Now that was one launch, and then there's two more going up as well. There's one on actually today, so I guess it'll probably be on the NASA website, July 4th, and then July 12th there'll be another one. Again, sounding rocket, not going into orbit, but they don't need to do whatever instruments they're sending up. I thought that was pretty good. With the Australia in the mix, more area, more countries involved, and more rocket companies involved, better off we are. We'll get to the point where we won't even know where the names of all these rocket companies. I'm sorry for losing the names. There's some from China, I don't even know. No names. There's just so many of them now. Spain is building one. Germany is building one. Norway is into it now. So, we'll try to cover them. Mostly, of course, cover NASA, but we'll try to cover different launch complexes around the world as well. Any comments?
Kilo 2, Lima, Oscar, Romeo.
Lima, Oscar, Romeo. Kilo 2, okay. Again, name is Paul. Back to you.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm in Queens in my mobile trying out.
you know, the cheap radio. But anyway, I've become interested in the satellite space stuff. I don't know much about it, but I know that when people talk about contacting ISIS, I went on and I set up my walkie-talkie for it, but I didn't set the car up for it yet, you know, the frequency and the uplink and the downlink, and I haven't tried it yet. And I watched, you know, how you get the satellite ISS detector, and I'm thinking of giving that a shot, but I was wondering how much, do I need a lot of power when it goes over to reach it? Because the walkie-talkie is 8 watts, and the car radio is about 25 watts, and I forgot the frequency.
Okay, if I have it. Okay, Mike, yeah. And all the frequencies are given on the AMSAT, AMSAT, AMSAT website. There's so many of them, the different ones that they use. But they have the up frequency and the down frequencies. Most of them are split now between 70 centimeters and 2 meters. They have a repeater on board now. They just put back into operation. I've never worked it. That's your best bet. And power wise, the most you have is 8 watts. Actually, that would work. More or less of an antenna problem. A lot of people have these Yagis. There's actually people that take small Yagis, maybe 5 elements or 3 elements. They'll actually hold them in their hand. They know when the satellite's coming overhead. If they go to the website, they know. I have the ISS detector, or some people use Heavens Above, another good one. And they know when it's coming overhead, it's roughly a 12-minute pass. You have to hope one of the astronauts is talking at the time. It happens. One guy up there now, Joe's getting right, he worked somebody about a month ago. The guy put it on the YouTube. The guy was down in the Carolinas and he had this little Yagi in his hand and he was pointing it. And he had it looked like a small mobile radio attached to it. So I don't know how many watts, I think it was pushing 25 watts or something.
Yeah, thanks for the answer. I appreciate it. I think a Yagi would be the best thing because directing it, you know, especially when I'm not dealing with a lot of power. I guess I would have to, you know, look into those antennas, which I haven't used the Yagi. I'm relatively new ham. So far, it's just been a mobile antenna, mobile magnetic mounts, and regular verticals they are, you know. And then at home on HF, I got magnetic loop. But, I'll just look into Yagis, and thanks for the answer. To me, it's a great, I heard that when they go over, they sometimes talk with kids in the school if the timing is right. But right now, I think it's going over at 3 a.m., basically, these days anyway. You know, in the New York area, it's going around, going over about 3 a.m., so...
Okay, Mike, you got up to 3 a.m. and then I lost you. But, you go to, I like watching the spacecraft, the ISS go overhead. You see, like, you know, minus 2.5 magnitude, or minus 3 or minus 5. When they say minus 3, minus 4, minus 5, just that means it's the brightest, you know. And then I can see, these things go right overhead, you know, it's great. You see, say, a 45 degree pass, or higher, you know, 60 or even 70 or 80 degree pass, you know, go right over your house. Clear night, it's great, but for radio fans, of course, it'd be any time of day and night. Heavens above, I think it's good for that. And the schools, this club, Weimark, has done many times with schools, different schools. I know there's just Freeport, a couple of other schools. I did it with my daughter. Teaching out east, I'm out in Suffolk County, and that school petitioned to do it, or requested to do it, and it takes like a year's work for the school system. I mean, everybody in the school, the grade school, gets involved. They do a whole kind of fake projects all year long, and finally it culminates into the contact itself. You know, I got involved with that, and sure enough, on that day, you know, they had everybody in the auditorium, and it was pretty cool. They had 12 children that got to ask questions, and they had enough time to go to all the kids. In fact, they went around again, and it's planned with NASA, and NASA, Aries, all this year. Amateur radio on the International Space Station. And again, you know, they ask questions, and the astronaut answers their questions. In our case, it was Jack Fisher, the astronaut that was doing it. And the kids were thrilled, and so was I. But, and personally, though, I've never been able to transmit. I haven't tried that much. I did listen a lot, especially actually before the International Space Station. Back in 1992, from March to, in the March, beginning of April, SDS 45 went up. It was an Atlantis space launch before the International Space Station. We didn't have but they did have SARAX, Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment, and so, you know, once in a while they would be contacting Earth, and sure enough, I knew the times that they said they were going to be doing it, and they were transmitting, and I went to the proper room, and that case was a 2-meter reception. I think it was 145-800. Sure enough, I heard them going over the house, and what they had was, if you heard them, and you heard who they contacted, I tried, but they didn't contact me, but if you heard who they contacted, you could send it into NASA, and they would eventually send you a QSL card back, and it took like, I don't know, 6 to 8 months. Eventually, one day, I got a card, you know, a picture of the crew. Regular QSL card, a picture of the shuttle, so, you know, very nice. That's the closest I got, actually, personally anyway, just actually hearing them going over. I don't put enough time into listening and trying to actually transmit up to the space station. It's doable. So good luck with that. K2LRWS2N.
WS2N, thanks a lot. I found out that I'm sorry, but to me, my interest from radio, I'm a recent ham and new to it, but ever since I was a kid, it's the radio chatter in movies and stuff. especially in military movies or science fiction like Star Wars or military movies, they always would have back and forth radio stuff, and it would kind of increase the action in the film and make it more interesting. So that was always in the back of my mind, and now to be able to put the radio hobby together with actually talking to someone out in space, that kind of, because a lot of these movies that I'm talking about, like, I hate to talk about Star Wars, that's all, you know, everyone talks about that, but I mean, in one of the first movies, see, when I first heard sci-fi,